content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. This is a double issue, this edition, and the general cover story, there are many items on the cover, the general cover story is the South issue. It is a double volume. We'll go right to the beginning and get as much content in as possible. And at first, we are in the major section called The Brief. And the first subsection in The Brief is Opener. And the section within Opener is Nation, where the headline is Losing Reporters Where It Matters Most by Carl Vick. The New York Daily News was cut in half by something called a trunk. That sounds like the sort of thing you'd find in a tabloid, and there it was in the July 23rd edition of New York's hometown newspaper on page 2. Quote, news cuts staff, half laid off in retool, unquote. Trunk turns out to be not a monster from the future, but a company from the past, Tribune Publishing, which renamed itself in a bid to remain relevant in a profoundly inhospitable present. By the way, Trunk is spelled capital T-R-O-N-C. That newspapers are a casualty of the information age may qualify as irony, but there are deep veins of tragedy involved, especially for communities that used to have a lot more people paid by the local paper to pay attention to what was happening there. We all know why they're gone. The bad news about the Daily News was almost a day old by the time it appeared in its own pages. The announcement had been made at 9 a.m. the day before, as millions of office workers were sitting down at their desks, opening web browsers and toggling between work screens and whatever caught their attention on the web. A 2017 Pew Research Center study found that 67% of the U.S. population consumes the news in bits on social feeds and streams rather than from anything brought in from the front porch or the bushes beside it. Daily newspaper circulation is right about where it was in 1940, a heyday for the printed word. The nation had only 40% of today's population back then, but the daily news circulation was nearly 2 million. It's now one-tenth that. A June report from Pew lays out the damage. Newspapers' revenue from ads is where it was in 1981. Papers employ barely half the number of people they did 14 years ago and pay them a median salary of $34,000. Regional papers that once vied for Pulitzer Prizes, the Mercury News of San Jose, the Denver Post, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, have been gathered up by hedge funds skilled at wringing profits from diminishing assets. Only a tiny handful of papers, most visibly the New York Times, have remained vibrant by investing constantly in digital and persuading subscribers to pay handsomely for a top-quality product. But they are national newspapers, conspicuous as a check on the federal government. The Times saw a surge in subscriptions after Donald Trump was elected. As papers like the Daily News shrink or die, the local is what's left behind. Even the Times stopped publishing a metro section. There is more to the article, but in the interest of getting as much material in as possible, we are moving on. We will share this metric that is in the center of the article. It's three items, top item. 67%. Caption explains, portion of American adults who in 2017 relied on social media sites for at least some of their news, according to a Pew Research Center's report. Middle item, $34,000. Median salary for American newspaper reporters in 2017, according to Pew analysis of Bureau of Labor Statistics data. Final item, 9. Caption explains, number of staff journalists remaining in the Daily News sports department down from 34 prior to the cuts. And still in the brief, the subsection here is news, and the interior section in news is the bulletin, where the headline is Cuba moves away from its communist past and toward a modern future, by Sierra Nugent. Cuba is set to turn the page on decades of communism after lawmakers approved a rewrite of its 42-year-old constitution that would fundamentally reshape the island's government, society, and economy. But although the document removes a national goal to build a, quote, communist society, unquote, the party will still be in charge. Sierra Nugent lists 3 items. First item, constitutional overhaul. For the first time since the Cold War, Cubans will be able to own private property, strengthening a fledgling private sector economy that now employs 12% of the workforce. The country will bring in age and term limits for presidents and create a prime minister role, ensuring that future leaders will not enjoy the level of personal power that the late Fidel Castro and his brother Raul exercised for 59 years until Raul installed successor Miguel Diaz-Canel in April. Social changes are also on the way, with same-sex marriage likely to be legally recognized. Second item, limited freedoms. Diaz-Canel says a planned public consultation and vote on the Constitution show that Cuba is now a, quote, genuine democracy, unquote. But one-party rule remains, and most senators from the Castro days are staying on. Entrepreneurs say the government's progressive tone contrasts with its actions. In July, it announced tighter restrictions on businesses after a year-long freeze on new licenses. Chile-U.S.-Cuba relations will further temper foreign investment. Final item. New world. Cuba is trying to adapt to a world very different from the one in which the 1976 Constitution was written. The Soviet Union is long gone, and an ideological fellow traveler, Venezuela, authoritarian socialism has collapsed into humanitarian crisis. Cuba's weak economic growth has not been enough to compensate the loss of its former benefactors, and it's been forced to cut energy use and imports, making reforms more urgent. But leaders insist that they are, quote, not renouncing their ideas, unquote, aiming for an incremental transition to a, quote, prosperous, unquote, socialism, rather than full-blown capitalism. Cuba is changing, but the party will set the pace. Entire article by Sierra Nugent. Sharing this page is the recurring sidebar feature News Ticker. It lists 3 news items stacked top to bottom. Top item, destruction after Laos dam fails. At least 26 people died in southeastern Laos after a billion-dollar hydropower dam collapsed while under construction on July 23rd, flooding 7 villages. Environmental groups have warned about the rapid pace of dam building as Laos seeks to become a major energy producer. Middle item, classified Carter Page files revealed. The FBI and the Justice Department released previously classified files on the Bureau's wiretapping of Carter Page, a foreign policy advisor to President Trump's campaign. Legal experts say the files undermined claims Trump's allies made about the wiretapping. Trump argued that they, quote, discredited, unquote, the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Final item. Kenya slum bulldozed to build highway. Authorities demolished the homes of some 30,000 people living in Kibera, Nairobi's largest slum, to make way for a new $20 million highway. Residents filed two legal challenges, but lost when a judge ruled the road was in the public interest. They were given 2 weeks' notice to leave. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, and still in the news subsection, and the Interior Division here is Good Question. The headline is, What Are the Real Costs of the Endangered Species Act? By Justin Warland. In the 45 years since President Richard Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act, parenthetically ESA, into law, conservationists have used the landmark legislation to protect millions of acres of land and bring animals, including the grizzly bear and the American alligator, back from the brink of extinction. But despite its successes, the law is controversial, particularly for a range of industries that have argued for decades that that compliance places too high a cost on companies. Because the ESA specifies how humans can use land in ways that harm threatened or endangered species habitats, some companies say its strict regulations are unnecessarily burdensome. On July 19th, the Trump administration delivered for those interests. In 118 pages of technical documents, the Department of the Interior proposed making it harder to protect new land, adding rules that might allow regulators to ignore the effects of climate change and, perhaps most significantly, removing a ban on factoring in cost when deciding how and whether to protect a species. The measure joins proposed legislation from Republicans on Capitol Hill that would defang the law and, in some cases, explicitly remove some animals from the endangered species list. Quote, the status quo is not good enough, unquote, said GOP Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee. Reforms, quote, will promote the recovery of species and allow local economies to flourish, unquote. Republicans see an opportunity to help key constituencies before the midterm elections. The oil and gas industry has complained that the law has halted the development of millions of acres of land. The logging industry has cited the law as a barrier to its growth, and farmers who own their land often complain that they cannot develop it. Conservation groups and the environmental lobby disagree about the cost-benefit analysis. Though there are economic costs for those industries, they say there's a bigger picture. The ESA protects not only individual species, but also entire ecosystems. Those ecosystems help ensure everything from clean drinking water to a hospitable climate. Not just for select areas, but for the entire nation. A 2011 study prepared for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, a government-affiliated conservation group, calculated the total value of those attendant benefits at about $1.6 trillion annually in the U.S. The American people seem happy to bear added costs in exchange. Multiple studies show that the vast majority support the law and would be willing to pay to preserve iconic species like the bald eagle. And experts argue there's no question proposed changes would hurt a law that must be strict to work. That pays off, says Jason Shogren, an environmental economics professor at the University of Wyoming. Quote, "We have to think about all the non-market benefits that exist for knowing the web of life is intact," unquote. Entire article by Justin Warland. In the sidebar of this page is another edition of the recurring feature News Ticker. And again, three news items stacked top to bottom. Top item. Veterans Affairs head confirmed. The Senate voted 86-9 to confirm Robert Wilkie, Trump's pick for Veterans Affairs Secretary. The department's 360,000 employees have been without a leader since March and are struggling to provide care in the face of thousands of staff vacancies and high turnover. Middle item, record levels of violence in Mexico. Mexico is on track to break its own record for murder for the second year running, after homicides rose 16% in the first half of 2018. Its homicide rate of 22 per 100,000 people is one of the world's highest, a problem traced to corruption, a shortage of police officers, and the fragmentation of drug gangs, among other causes. Final item, 17 dead in duck boat sinking. 17 people, including 9 members of one family, died on July 20th when an amphibious duck boat for tourists sank during a heavy storm near Branson, Missouri. 14 people survived, including the boat's captain. The incident has led to calls for regulation of duck boat tours. Also on this page, running along the bottom, is a mini feature called Royals, and the headline is Married to the Monarchy by Abigail Abrams. She writes, Japan's Imperial Household Agency asked Fordham University not to call its princess's intended her fiancé before their official betrothal. Here, royal couple controversies. Abigail Abrams lists 3 of them, running left to right at the bottom of the page. At the left, item 1, Dutch mess. Former Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands married German diplomat Klaus von Arnsberg in 1966, sparking protests because he had been a Hitler Youth member and fought for Germany in World War II. Middle item, abdication. Edward VIII took the British throne in 1936, but abdicated soon after in order to marry Wallis Simpson, an American divorcee, a move that was against royal rules. They stayed married until his death. Final item, Norwegian wood. That's spelled W-O-U-L-D. Norway's Prince Haakon Magnus shocked his country when he said in 2000 he would marry Mette Marit Tessem Holby, a commoner and single mother. The two originally met at a music festival. Moving ahead, and we are now at the milestones page. The lead item, under died. Jonathan Gold, Epicurean Angelino. Observance written by Lisa Abent. Quote, "It's the coldest night of the year," unquote, began one of Jonathan Gold's 2006 reviews. Quote, and I am driving along Olympic Boulevard in East Los Angeles, ravenously hungry, looking for one of the itinerant, flame-throwing taco carts that sprout in that neighborhood around midnight, unquote. Those words would help Gold become, in 2007, the only food critic ever awarded a Pulitzer Prize. But they also convey something of the man himself, unpretentious, lyrical, enthralled by his hometown, and always, always hungry. Gold, who died on July 21st at 57, changed American food writing. In his long career reviewing for L.A. Weekly and the Los Angeles Times, he brought his intellect and experience not only to the city's Tony dining rooms, but also especially to the no-name taquerias, Thai curry joints, and strip mall noodle houses that crisscross Los Angeles. He was driven by a deep understanding of how food creates community, and often said he hoped his reviews would help convince Angelenos to be more adventurous and less afraid of their neighbors. The legacy of this democratizing mission can be seen in the Instagramming foodies who prowl the world now for a taste of fish kidneys or pigskin pupusas. In that 2006 review, he paid tribute to the, quote, great brotherhood of taco eaters, unquote, in Los Angeles, quote, huddled around trucks late at night, balancing 3 ounces of highly spiced meat, and drawing furtively from an icy bottle of imported Mexican Coke, unquote. If that brotherhood exists, it is in large part because Gold created it. Observance by Lisa Abent. This item is accompanied by a full-color, almost full-length photograph of Jonathan Gold. The caption says, "The food writer Gold on March 25th. Also under Died, Shinobu Hashimoto, screen storyteller. Observance by Antoine Fuqua. And time notes, Fuqua directed 2016's The Magnificent Seven and The Equalizer 2 in theaters now. Antoine Fuqua writes, I first saw Seven Samurai at some small theater in downtown Pittsburgh, and it took me to another place. The writing by Shinobu Hashimoto, who died on July 19th at 100, working with Akira Kurosawa and Hideo Uguni, was so beautiful and poetic and powerful and heartbreaking. It was all about justice, it was all about sacrifice, and it made me want to be one of those guys. I came from a rough area, and I had my own version of watching poor people getting pushed down, whoever the person was who had the power. They would come in and take from other people. And when I saw The Magnificent Seven, a direct take from Seven Samurai, again, I found myself wanting to be one of those guys. So when they called me from MGM and asked me about remaking it, I couldn't say no. Seven Samurai, a foreign film from the 1950s in Japan, affected a boy from Pittsburgh living in the ghetto. That tells you it's a universal story about a universal reason that people fight for justice. The process between Kurosawa and Hashimoto, who also wrote Rashomon, wasn't about ego as much as it was about what's best for the story. And I keep seeing that story being told over and over again. A lot of people don't know Hashimoto's name, but his legacy will live on forever through his movies and the stories and the people who are influenced by them. Observance by Antoine Fuqua about screen storyteller Shinobu Hashimoto. Under Long Listed, Nick DiNarso's Sabrina for the Man Booker Prize, the first time a graphic novel has been up for the most prestigious UK literary award. Under announced, a bid to chair the House Democratic Caucus by Representative Barbara Lee, a vocal progressive. If she succeeds, she'd be the first black woman to hold a leadership position in a major U.S. political party. Under planned, $12 billion in emergency aid for U.S. farmers hurt by foreign tariffs imposed in retaliation for President Trump's moves on trade by his administration. Under assumed, 10 seats in Colombia's Congress by former FARC rebels, that's all caps F-A-R-C, on July 20th as part of a 2016 peace deal. Outgoing Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos welcomed them and urged lawmakers to protect the peace. Under fired, Russian soccer player Irving Potokayubama, whose parents are Congolese, by the team Torpedo Moscow, after some of the club's fans unleashed an outpouring of racist reaction to news of his signing just days earlier. Under ordained, most members of the Thai youth soccer team rescued from a flooded cave as Buddhist novices on July 25th. The ceremony traditionally demonstrates gratitude. Moving ahead, and we are now in the View section, and the subsection is Sports, where the headline is Baseball's Long Game by Susan Jacoby. She writes, baseball is a booming business, one with record annual revenues of more than $10 billion. Yes, billion. Still, it faces a big problem. Baseball has the oldest fan base of any major sport, and there is a dissonance between the focus and attention it demands and the habits of younger generations who expect action to be a click away. Although it's difficult to make direct year-to-year comparisons because of the increase in viewing on digital devices, the trend over the past decade is clear in numerous studies, including the venerable Nielsen ratings. The average age of those who watch nationally televised Major League Baseball games rose from 52 in 2000 to 57 in 2016. Parenthetically, the average age of National Basketball Association viewers is 42. Asking a survey whether they followed baseball, nearly two-thirds of those ages 18 to 36 said no. Michael Haupert, a professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, who studies baseball as a business, explains why so many young people might be bored by what to an older and more knowledgeable fan is one of the most exciting experiences in sports, a no-hitter. Quote, failure is more common than success in baseball, unquote, he says. Quote, if my students get a third of the answers right on their test, they flunk. If a ball player gets a hit a third of the time, he's often one of the stars, unquote. But watch an NBA game for 15 seconds and you will likely see one team score. It is not surprising that decreasing the length of games, about 3 hours in recent years, and increasing the pace of action has become a subject of contention among those who love baseball. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred is strongly committed to both. For the 2018 season, the league issued a set of new rules designed to do just that. Mound visits are limited. A time countdown is designed to shorten the break between innings. New phone lines connect each club's video review rooms and the dugout, with the supposed purpose of monitoring communications and discouraging sign stealing. Parenthetically, I must confess that I have always found stealing signs amusing. and something any team manager with a brain can find ways to discourage. The changes do not include a pitch clock, something Manfred wants and about which the head of the players' union, Tony Clark, is dubious. Limiting the time a pitcher has to deliver the ball to the plate would, in my view, fundamentally impede the psychological warfare between pitcher and batter that makes baseball, well, baseball. No one knows if any of these changes will significantly shorten games. According to MLB, the average length of a 9-inning outing this season has been 3 hours, about 5 minutes shorter than the 2017 average, itself the longest mean on record. There is more to this article, but again, in the interest of more material from more places, we move on. Time does note that Susan Jacoby is the author most recently of Why Baseball Matters. Jacoby is spelled J-O-C-O-B-Y. On this page is a sidebar feature called Short Reads. Tom explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. It lists three items. Top item, why dogs love humans. Time's Jeffrey Kluger recounts the history of humanity's special bond with canines, one that is so great that we understand what they're barking about. Quote, think that's not a big deal, unquote, he writes. Quote, then answer this. What does a happy bird look like? A sad lion? You don't know, but dog talk, you get. Unquote. Middle item. The overuse of breathing machines. Intrusive breathing tools are often used on older patients who may be nearing death, writes Dr. Kiyuchi of Brigham and Women's Hospital, even though that may not represent their wishes. Quote, most patients would not consider this arrangement an acceptable way of living, yet so many of them experience it as their final form of life. Unquote. Final item. Breaking the breastfeeding stigma. Photographer Gina Brocker shares her portraits of women breastfeeding at home, in public, and in transit. She tells Time, quote, I hope when people see this series, if they are breastfeeding, they feel empowered to do what they want. Unquote. All three features are short reads, highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. Moving ahead, and we are now in the subsection called World, where the headline is War of Words. As America's long-running regional contest with Iran heats up, Trump and Tehran are fueling the fire with rhetoric, money, and guns, by W.J. Hennigan. Hennigan writes, inside a stately boardroom at the Federal Ministry of Finance in Berlin last April, U.S. Treasury Department officials meeting with their German counterparts described an elaborate Iranian operation that the Americans had uncovered. For several years, Iran's elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps had been using German front companies to buy advanced printing machinery, watermark paper, and specialty inks in violation of European export controls. Parenthetically, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is known also here as IRGC. The IRGC had then printed counterfeit Yemeni banknotes, potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and used them to help fund its proxy war against the beleaguered pro-U.S. government in the capital of Sana'a. German companies, the Americans said, were being used as a cover by the Iranians to finance the world's worst humanitarian conflict. The evidence, uncovered by U.S. illicit finance investigators, was meant to sway the Germans, but not just in hopes of countering Iran's moves on the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. The larger mission, according to other Treasury documents later used in a presentation and reviewed by Time, was to convince Berlin that Tehran cannot be trusted and that the Germans should join the Trump administration in imposing economy-crippling sanctions on Iran. Weeks later, the American officials presented their hosts with one last set of documents, detailed blueprints on how the Trump administration was preparing to unleash financial warfare on the Iranian economy. There is much more to this article, and again, in the interest of inclusion, we move on. Before we do, there is a graphic chart and map included in this article. It's called A Radiating Network. Time's caption says, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has bolstered its longtime support for rebel groups and other militants across the Middle East since the 2015 nuclear deal. The sphere of influence includes an emerging land route, a conduit for fighters, weapons, and supplies that runs to the Mediterranean Sea. It mentions several items around the Middle East. First item, Hezbollah, the internationally sanctioned anti-Israel and anti-U.S. terrorist group, receives money and weapons from Iran. Assad regime. Iran backs Bashar Assad, providing his troops with intelligence and military support, including its Quds force. Time defines Quds force. This elite division of Iran's military corps specializes in providing training, funding, and weapons to extremists. Under Hashid al-Sha'abi, also known as Popular Mobilization Forces, these Shiite militias fight with the Iraqi army against Sunni rebels. In Afghanistan, Shiite Hazara, members of this ethnic minority, have been recruited by Iran to fight alongside government forces in Syria. And Houthis, these anti-government insurgents overthrew the Yemeni regime in 2015, escalating a proxy war. And moving ahead, still in the world section, and the story here is The Tourism Trap by Lisa Abent. As vacationers threaten to turn Europe into a theme park, the continent is pushing back. Dateline Venice. In Giovanni Bonazzone's paintings, Venice is a vision of serenity. Bridges arch gracefully over rippling canals. Sunlight bounces off flower-filled balconies, and not a single human mars the tranquility. Bonazzone's Daily Vista is not as tranquil, however. An artist who paints and sells watercolors from an easel set up near San Marco Square, he has a ringside seat to the selfie-posing, ice-cream-licking hordes who roil their way daily toward the Doge's palace, and he readily agrees that tourism is killing his hometown. Yet, when he heard that Venice mayor Luigi Brugnaro had, in the run-up to a busy weekend at the beginning of May, installed checkpoints intended to block arriving visitors from especially crowded thoroughfares, while allowing locals through, Bonazzone was dismayed. Quote, yes, they should control the tourists, unquote, he says. Quote, but they shouldn't close Venice. We're a city, not a theme park, unquote. That's a refrain echoing in a growing number of European cities. The neoclassical gems that once made up the Grand Tour have been stops on package tours since the 19th century. But it's only over the past decade or so that the number of travelers to these and other must-see destinations risks subsuming the places. Around 87 million tourists visited France in 2017, breaking records. 58.3 million went to Italy. And even the tiny Netherlands received 17.9 million visitors. It's happening nearly everywhere. Asia experienced a 9% increase in international visitors in 2016, and in Latin America, the contribution of tourism to GDP is expected to rise by 3.4% this year. Even a devastating hurricane season couldn't halt arrivals in the Caribbean, where tourism grew 1.7% in 2017. The U.S., on the other hand, has seen foreign tourism drop, partly because of a strong dollar. But Europe is bearing the brunt. Of the 1.3 billion international arrivals counted by the UN worldwide last year, 51% were in Europe, an 8% increase over the year before. Americans in particular seem drawn to the perceived glamour and sophistication of the old continent, as well as the increased spending power of a strong currency. More than 15.7 million U.S. tourists crossed the Atlantic in 2017, a 16% jump in the space of a year. With tourism in 2018 expected to surpass previous records, frustration in Europe is growing. This past spring witnessed anti-tourism demonstrations in many cities throughout Europe. On July 14th, demonstrators in Mallorca, Spain, conducting a quote, summer of action, unquote, greeted passengers at the airport with signs reading, quote, tourism kills Mallorca, unquote. That's all caps. Now, local governments are trying to curb or at least channel the surges that clog streets, diminish housing supplies, pollute waters, turn markets and monuments into no-go zones, and generally make life miserable for residents. Yet, almost all of them are learning that it can be far more difficult to stem the tourist hordes than it was to attract them in the first place. The reasons for this modern explosion in tourism are nearly as numerous as the guys selling selfie sticks in Piazza Navona. Low-cost airlines like EasyJet, Ryanair, and Vueling expanded dramatically in the 2000s, with competitive ticket prices driving up passenger numbers. From 2008 to 2016, the cruise ship industry in Europe exploded, growing by 49%. Airbnb, which launched in 2008, made accommodations less expensive. Rising prosperity in countries like China and India has turned their burgeoning middle classes into avid travelers. Even climate change plays a role, as warmer temperatures extend summer seasons and open up previously inaccessible areas. But the cities and local governments here also share responsibility for the boom, having attempted to stimulate tourism to raise money. In the decade since the financial crisis began, tourism has come to be seen by European countries as an economic lifesaver. The industry generated $321 billion for the EU in 2016 and now employs 12 million people. Governments in cities like Barcelona spent heavily to attract tourist dollars. Quote, for decades, the government here was using tons of public money to attract cruise lines, new hotels, new airlines, unquote, says Daniel Pardo, a member of the city's Neighborhood Assembly for Sustainable Tourism. Quote, but they didn't think about the repercussions, unquote. Barcelona is one of the cities that got more than it bargained for. Every day in high season now, four or five cruise ships dock in the Catalan capital, spilling thousands of passengers at the base of the famous Rambla Boulevard. Quote, you can't walk there, unquote, Pardo says. Quote, you can't shop at the Boca Rio market. You can't get on a bus because it's packed with tourists, unquote. Over the past few years, Barcelona has begun taking action to improve tourist behavior, like fining visitors who walk around the city center in their bathing suits. The current mayor, Ada Colau, has dramatically intensified that action. In January 2017, her government prohibited the construction of new hotels in the city center and prevents their replacement when old ones close. Cruise ships that stop for the day may struggle to get docking licenses as the city prioritizes those that begin or end their journey in Barcelona. Tour groups can now visit the Boca Rio market only at certain times, and the city is considering measures to ensure locals can still buy raw ingredients there and not just smoothies and paper cones of ham. Quote, there is a risk that some areas of the city, like Sagrada Familia or the Boca Rio, will become amusement parks, unquote, says Agustí Colom, the city councilman for tourism. Quote, but we're still in time to save them. We understand that Barcelona cannot become an economic monoculture, unquote. Other places are also turning to the law to reduce the number of globetrotters. Ever since its medieval center stood in for King's Landing on Game of Thrones, the walled Croatian city of Dubrovnik has been overwhelmed by fans of the HBO series. In 2017, Dubrovnik limited the number of daily visitors to 8,000. Its new mayor now seeks to halve that amount, have spelled H-A-L-V-E. Amsterdam, whose infamous drug culture and picturesque canals drew at least 6 million foreign visitors to the city in 2016, has adopted a carrot-and-stick approach. The Dutch capital has introduced fines for rowdy behavior and banned the mobile bars known as beer bikes, while simultaneously attempting to lure visitors to less congested sites like Zandvoort, a coastal town 17 miles from the city center that has been rebranded Amsterdam Beach through apps and messaging systems. The city also raised its tourist tax to 6%, joining several other cities and some countries that aim to control visitor numbers with higher levies. At the start of 2018, Greece imposed its first tourist tax, which ranges from roughly 50 cents a night to 4 euros. In Iceland, which receives nearly 7 times as many visitors as it has residents, lawmakers will consider a tax this fall on tourists coming from outside of Europe. Yet even in liberal Europe, not every government is willing to raise taxes. Authorities in the Lofoten Islands in northern Norway beseeched the government to raise levies after more than 1 million tourists visited in 2017, thanks in part to the movie Frozen. The 25,000 inhabitants found their single main road and its sparse facilities completely overwhelmed. When Norway said no to higher taxes, the locals were forced to take matters into their own hands. Quote, we've organized community volunteers to build trails and haul trash, unquote, says Flakstad Mayor Hans Fredrik Sordal. Quote, in summer, we're opening the school toilets to the public, and we're asking tourists for volunteer contributions, unquote. For locals in these places, anger at the ever-expanding rates of tourism can be placated by the money there is to be made out of catering to them. The advent of Airbnb has created a revenue stream for city center residents with spare bedrooms and second properties. The company sees itself as an answer to tourism overcrowding rather than a net contributor. Quote, "We're convinced our community can be a solution to mass tourism," unquote, wrote company founder Nathan Blicharczyk in a May report, quote, "and that it enables sustainable growth that benefits everyone," unquote. Yet some people benefit more than others. Canny investors buy up residential properties in desirable locations and convert them into tourist apartments, provoking housing shortages and pushing up prices. There is a lot more to this article, and again, we're moving on for inclusion. There is an article within an article here called Too Much Baggage. Caption explains, regulations and campaigns across Europe aim to ebb the flow of 671 million tourists and address their unwanted impact on local communities. There are several examples. First example, limited lodging. In April, the city of Paris sued Airbnb and other rental sites for listing homes that did not comply with permit regulations. Second example, crowd controls. Barcelona restricts construction of tourist lodging, and the city's famous market prohibits large groups at certain times. Another example, higher taxes. This fall, Iceland's lawmakers are expected to consider a tax on tourists coming from outside Europe. Another example, steep fines. In May, the Dutch capital began fining for drunkenness, excessive noise, littering, and public urination. Another example, restricted booze. During last year's high tourist season, Rome banned drinking on the streets after 10 p.m. and alcohol sales in bars after 2 a.m. Another example, dispersion tactics. Venice is promoting travel to the Lagoon Islands and the mainland in an attempt to lure visitors out of the city center. Final example, visitor caps. Cameras installed in the Old Town section of Dubrovnik, Croatia, help to enforce an 8,000 tourist per day limit. Also is a graphic feature sidebar included here called the Hot Spots. Caption explains, traditional hubs like Spain and Italy have had steady tourism growth, while countries like Iceland are grappling with recent and dramatic spikes. And the examples here, starting from greatest to less, Iceland, 230%, Greece, 75%, Croatia, 50%, Spain, 42%, Italy, 26%. And moving ahead, and the cover story was the South, and we come now in that section, a subsection called Politics, where the headline is Drawlin' for Votes, What Democrats Don't Get About the South, by David French. Times says, French, a lifelong Southerner, is a senior writer for National Review and a former major in the U.S. Army Reserve. There is no accent quite like the Southern accent, and there is no Southern accent quite like the Southern politicians. Spend any time in the South, especially in the rapidly growing suburban and exurban South, and you'll hear the drawl. The men sound just a tiny bit folksier, as if your doctor would be just as comfortable plowing a field as he would be reading an X-ray. The women sound nice, so that the same words you hear in daily life across the U.S. somehow come off kinder and gentler. But there is nothing, absolutely nothing, subtle about the Southern politician's accent. No, sir. To hear the Southern politician talk, is to hear the backwoods come to the big city. Their past profession doesn't matter. Neither does their upbringing. There's something about running for office in the South that exaggerates that drawl and drops all those G's. At its heart, Southern politics is cultural politics. That's because Southern politics isn't just about the South as it is, representing its concrete economic and religious interests. For example, it's also about the South as it sees itself. The idea of the South is very important to the people of the South, and it has been for a very long time. In 2018, the South sees itself as economically advanced but culturally traditional. It's proud of its industry and technology, but it's also proud of its faith and its families. The majority of the people don't hunt or fish or farm, but they feel connected to people who do. A Tennessee lawyer may never leave a paved road, but he'll drive a truck that can haul hay. Even people who don't own guns value the South's gun culture. They may not have a firearm, but they will not tolerate a government that restricts their ability to defend themselves. That's the idea of the South in 2018. Southerners love God. They respect the traditions of faith and family, including manners and respect for elders. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, and it was a double issue. We hope you've enjoyed this double issue. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, 919-832-5138. We sure enjoyed having you back with us again for this double edition of Time. Please join us next time. We'll be with you then with another edition. Until then, so long. Please join us next time for Time.